The topic that we're going to discuss this morning is full of grace and truth. And that is drawn from what I consider a pivotal scripture. It's pivotal because it changed the world when it happened, and it is when the Word that had always been, and it was with the Father, and was there at the beginning, and active in the Old Testament, and able to create from nothing the entirety of the world. So that is a being that, by any estimation, is almost beyond description. And then we read, or John wrote, and there's a reason he wrote this. And actually, I think it is important for us to note that John's gospel, in how it's put together, is very different from the other three. That doesn't mean it's better, it's just different. And what John does is he grapples with the big questions of life, whereas the other gospels are primarily biographies of what Jesus Christ did. And part of that, I think, is simply because of the time frame in which John wrote. He wrote much later. He already was dealing with the heresies that came to be. And so it's more philosophical. And when he said, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." So as the title suggests, what I want to focus on is the fact that Jesus, or John in this case, said that Christ came. He came and became flesh, but even so, he was full of two components, grace and truth. Now, I think we have, in the church, done a really good job of articulating truth. That's been, you know, our kind of a central core of our message. You know, I could ask the question, and I think I did here some time ago, you know, I think you can see, you get to understand groups of people by their inspeak. And if you work in any organization long enough, you will learn that there are certain things that people say in a group that is understood, that if you were to use the same phrase to people not in the group, would maybe be a little bit, I don't want to say mystical, it's not that, but it just wouldn't be fully comprehend. So, for example, one of the things that we have said in the church is, in a question that is often asked, when did you or how did you come to the knowledge of the truth? Okay, well, I mean, whatever does that mean? I mean, for us it means, okay, when did you come to understand the truth about the Sabbath, the holy days, Jesus Christ? I mean, it is one of those general statements that means different things to different people, but within the church, I think that is the core of what that means. And I think that also says something about the church as an organization. It shows that we have had a lot of focus on the truth, as opposed to, you know, a lot that is spread out there about, you know, Christianity that is, when you start looking at the Bible, is not consistent with what the Bible teaches. So I say that, and that is really important. I mean, you cannot overemphasize the importance of doctrinal integrity, because it forms the basis of who we are as a church, and more importantly, we'll see this in a minute, who we are. Now, the next thing, what's interesting here is that it says that Christ was full of both grace and truth. And what I want to do in this study is to build a framework on how to understand those two components. So if you have a piece of note paper, you can kind of draw what we'll build up there, and then I've got a handout for this afternoon and the sermon that shows this, but I didn't want to give it away, so We're going to do this incrementally. And I say not give it away. I think it's what I'm going to do with you is to kind of walk through it, okay? And how does this fit together and how does it build? And I don't have it up here with me. I mean, we just published a booklet, which I... How many of you got the booklet on grace? As I was in Youngstown, and several people hadn't gotten it, so a couple database issues. I read that, and actually, I'll be candid with you. The minute it made it online, I downloaded it, and then on one of my long rides back on an airplane, I read the thing cover to cover. And I told Scott Ashley, because he was at the feast where we were, so I'm not telling you anything that I haven't already told the author. I said, to be perfectly honest with you, I read it critically. And the reason I read it critically was I knew that if we published something on a topic of grace and didn't quite get it right, we would be in big trouble. And I think he understood that, and the council understood that as well. Here's my one sentence assessment of the booklet. It's the most comprehensive, coherent, cohesive thing I've ever read on the topic, so please read it. I think it is quite good. And some of that flows into what we're going to talk about today, and I'll quote from the booklet then in the sermon. Okay, so if Jesus Christ, according to John, is full of grace and truth, on the right side here, I guess, yeah, it's also on the right side up there, sometimes gets mixed up. Let's look at the truth component. Truth, Jesus said, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, of course, there are other components here, but here is a statement by Jesus Christ himself about the fact that he is truth. He's also the way, which speaks to methodology. He is truth, which speaks to, you know, just, well, truth. I don't know how you can describe that any better. And then finally, life. He is, he as is also the Father, has life in himself. So he modeled the way, he embodied truth, and he gives life. He also gives something else. So then we come back to the statement in John chapter 1, and you have grace and truth. So notice here, this is now on the left side. And this is something that Peter wrote much later, quoting actually from the Old Testament. And I think that's one important thing that one important point that the book makes is that the first mention of grace is that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So grace is not just a New Testament idea at all. You know, we didn't have a legalistic God of the Old Testament who was always angry with Israel, I might add, justifiably so, okay? And then all of a sudden you come into the new covenant and the New Testament, and all of a sudden we have flip-flopped, and now we've become this God who's just full of grace, and we can continue in our sin so that it may abound. So Peter said, God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. So, you know, I like to kind of set things up in my mind so I can, you know, categorize and memorize. So here's actually, I think, a good way to think about this. Truth is who Jesus Christ is. He also models the way. Whereas grace is what he came to give. And you know, again, if you look at this in these two components, I think it mentions or gives us a good way to think about it. I mean, I know the truth, which usually translates into I'm right, by the way. And you're wrong, of course. And now the problem begins. You know, how are you right? And you get into this. And that doesn't mean, of course, I'm right. I mean, you know that, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you're not right. Jesus Christ, I think what this is telling us, that even though Jesus Christ not only taught the truth, spoke the truth, and embodied truth, he was able to articulate it with grace. And even in doing so perfectly, ran into a lot of resistance and with the religious authorities of this day. So even though if you do it perfectly, it may not always come out just quite right. So, grace and truth. Truth is who he was. Grace is what he does. So it comes down to two operative words that I've been using in other connections. But really, when you think about life, it really comes down to, I mean, you can reduce a lot of things down to these two components: who we are and what we do, being and doing. So we'll look at it in those, in that particular context. So if you want to do some graphics and artwork in your notes, if you draw a line down the middle and write this stuff down, and then you have this nice little circular thing, doing and do and be. You know, do this, be that. Be this, do that. So think about this for just a moment, and then, you know, here's where you can raise your hand. Who we are determines what we see, think, say, and do. Who we are. Now, I've been floating this concept, and somebody said, "Oh no, you can't say that in all cases." Because sometimes people say things that aren't true, or they say things that are not, you know, they profess to be something that they're not. So how can you say that who we are determines what we see, say, think, and do? And I said, well, actually, even if you say something that isn't quite who you are, it becomes a true expression of who you actually are. Think about that one for a few minutes. Because in saying and pretending, might be by putting out a pretense that is different from who we actually are, does not take away from the validity of that statement. It only confirms it. As we've only confirmed the fact that we're a hypocrite. It's who we are. So if you're a hypocrite, what you do is pretend or act things out, which in so doing confirms who you actually are. So we can't really jump over our shadow, can we? It's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, I think until we come face to face with and comfortable with who we actually are, no meaningful change can take place. Because you're trying to change what you pretend to be. And then you change the wrong thing. And you're moving something that doesn't exist, which is why it's so difficult to change. I mean, that's how it works for you. For me, it's completely different. You know, I've got this all under control. I mean, if I didn't, you know, how would I ever be able to teach this? Well, actually, I've just done what I said people do. The reason that I have thought about this a lot is because of the very reasons I'm, you know, there's pretense. There are a lot of things about John Miller that you don't know that I don't like. I mean, maybe you do know, but those are just the realities. And until we acknowledge those things for what they are, there can be no meaningful change. Okay, so then there's the doing. I mean, you've heard the saying, it's all in the doing. What we do then determines who we become. If I am an alcoholic, what do I do? You drink. And if I, as an alcoholic, drink, who do I become? A bigger alcoholic. And then, because I've become even more addicted, what do I do then? You drink even more. Yeah, till you become, as you said, wasted. Yeah. This is a negative example. The positive works as well. I'll tell you a really sad story. There was a guy by the name of David Lauby. I have no idea if he's still alive, that I worked with on a electronics project, and he was working at that time for a company that had a plant in Tijuana. Just a brilliant, probably the most brilliant product engineer that I've ever met. And it was just a pleasure working with him because, you know, he had great ideas and you know, was very, just really, really good at his discipline. And one time I was in Tijuana, this goes back, 15, maybe even 20 years. And one time I was visiting his company, he said, "John, what are you doing tonight?" I said, "Well, nothing." He said, "Well, you know," I said, "Well, you want to go out to dinner?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'd like to bring my wife." I said, "Fine." So we went out to dinner and talked, and he had a beautiful Mexican wife that was considerably younger than he was, which, I mean, those kinds of things happen. And then he started telling me about his story. He said, "John, I'm an alcoholic." I said, "Oh, okay." And then he went on. He said, "If I take one drink, I will be on the street in a week." And it's like, how is that possible for a man of his level of intellect? And he then walked me through his kind of life story. These are the things that happen at dinner, in this case, without any alcohol. He was just, I guess, comfortable sharing his life. And so we talked about that and a few other things. And, you know, time went on, and he moved to another company and then called me, and we did some work there as well. And then all of a sudden, he disappeared. And so I remembered that conversation, so I called one of his colleagues and said, "Do you know where David Lauby went?" He said, "Well, it's kind of a sad story." I said, "Oh." So something happened in his life, and he took that one drink, and he was right back out in the street. So this is maybe not the best way to demonstrate the continuum between doing and being and who we are. It is also true that when we, this whole thing is kind of fed and built on our values, which is a different topic. As we do the right thing, it changes who we are, which then gives us the ability to do things differently, which changes who you are, and it just continues like that. Okay, so we'll walk through, see how we're doing here on Cho's watch. We got a little bit more time. All right. So let's walk through a couple of scriptures that support the the two components. So we'll walk down the truth side of, you know, this is what Jesus Christ embodied. And it in some of his statements with regard to truth also demonstrate the fact that it drives what we do. You know, the fact that Jesus Christ, by his own self disclosure or statement, said that he is truth drove what he did. Just like when we talk about, when did you come to the knowledge of the truth? It is a manner of speaking that drove behavioral results. So in this case, John chapter 8, verse 32, Jesus told the Jews, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The truth liberates. And one of the things that I'm thankful for is, I mean, when what's the statement? There's some type of statement out there that says that if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember the lies. You know, if you're a liar, you really have to remember everything you said so that you can spin another lie to kind of cover it up.
You don't have to worry about what you said.
What is the statement?
The statement is, if you're telling the truth, you don't have to worry about what you said.
If you're telling the truth, you don't have to worry about what you said. And believe me, I've found that out and lived that. And you know, sometimes you get yourself in trouble just because you misstated something, especially in a highly politically charged situation, which I often find myself in. Politics is not just in Washington. So back to this. The truth shall make you free. So while this is a statement about the being of Jesus Christ, who he was, the fact that knowing that makes you free shows that who we are drives what we do. In this case, speaking the truth and knowing the truth. And again, the fact that we have placed a lot of emphasis on knowing the truth is extremely important. I don't want to take away from that at all. However, having said that, I think it is also true that how you deliver that and how you live it out gains acceptance to the extent that we as Jesus Christ do it gracefully. John chapter 14, verse 6. Here's the statement. I am the way, the truth, and the life. So all of these things are statements of Christ's being. He is the way. He modeled it. You know, we talk about, and you know, the statement following Jesus Christ is broadly distributed, if you will. In fact, there's a group, a really interesting group that I found about last year, of a evangelical Christian who became a very, very conservative Anabaptist, which I found really fascinating on how did you make that trip. And he calls his group Followers of the Way. So this whole idea of the way, in fact, in Acts, it talks about that, you know, he talked about the way. So Jesus Christ embodies this. We are to follow him, which I always find fascinating that those who profess to follow Christ, but then go in exactly the opposite direction, you know? I mean, there are many different ways you can look at that, but let's just take the Sabbath, for example. You know, you follow Jesus Christ, who, as his custom was, went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. So it seems to me that if I want to follow that way, I would go into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stand up to read. I mean, if you want to take a very literal approach to that. I mean, that's why I think on the day of accounting, you know, Jesus will say, leave me, you, I have never known you. And then you've got the truths which we've been speaking of and life. Apart from God, there can be no life. Scientists are still trying to figure that out. There is no such thing as synthetic life. You can synthesize compounds. You can synthesize flavors. You can make a synthetic component of just about anything because you look at all the bits and pieces and you form the molecules and put it together. But life? From a non-life form, I mean, that's the biggest flaw in evolution. You know, how do you get from something that's dead to life? Jesus said, I am life. He also says that I have life in the Son has life in himself as the Father has life in himself. I think it is also interesting that in this connection, it says that no one comes to the Father except through me. Those are, like I said, John grapples with the big questions of life. Those are big questions. I mean, those are statements that are foundational but also exclusive. What this is saying is that the path to life is exclusively through Jesus Christ. That does not allow for, you know, philosophical explanations that good Hindus, good atheists, good, you know, you fill in the blank, somehow they also get to heaven. There's a logical fallacy there. It doesn't work. You know, what do you do with all the people that didn't know? I was in a meeting last week, and one of the guys brought a little comic. A cartoon, I should say. How many of you remember Dennis the Menace? Yeah, I see. Well, this was a knockoff Dennis the Menace. The kid looked pretty close to Dennis the Menace, but not close enough to infringe on copyright. And you had these kids lined up in church pews, and they're having Sunday school. And you have a guy standing in front, obviously teaching, and he's got the Bible in his hand. And little Menace stands up and raises his hand with the caption. He said, so let me get this straight. The God who teaches us to love our enemies tortures his enemies in hell forever. Out of the mouths of babes. You see, if you claim to own the exclusive way to life, which Jesus does, and you teach your followers to love their enemies, but then on the other hand, you torture your enemies in hell forever. Now, I've got a double standard. Of course, the Bible doesn't teach that in that way. I just found it was a really insightful observation. John chapter 16, verse 13, again on the topic of truth. However, when the Spirit of truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth. For he will not speak of his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will tell you things to come. So here you have, again, we talk about being and doing. The Bible states that God is spirit. It is his essence. I mean, theologians have argued whether the word is substance or essence. We have used the word essence, but it's the essence of who he is, or you know, to put it colloquially, it's spirit is what he's made up of. So when he comes, the Spirit of truth, we're talking about the power and the essence of God coming to us to do what? To guide you into all truth. And he will not speak of his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will tell you things to come. Now, the word he in English is problematic because I just had that discussion. You were having this discussion last week, and actually Leah and I talked about it last night, about the whole concept of putting gender to a noun. In just about every other Western language, the personal pronoun assigned to a noun has very little to do with sexuality or even persons, because, you know, car in German, for example, is depends on which word you use. It's das Auto, der Wagen. So you go from neuter to masculine for the same object just because you have a different name for it. And then when you talk about it as a pronoun, you use the appropriate one. So it has nothing to do with, I mean, obviously a car is not a person. But it has, in this case, truth is so much a part of Jesus Christ's being that it is the Holy Spirit and will lead us into more truth, which when you come to the knowledge of the truth, it then will guide what you do. Otherwise, you haven't come to the knowledge of the truth. You haven't been convicted. There are a lot of people that are curious about any number of things. When you become convicted, you actually do something. So let's look at the doing. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Now think about what is extended to us. Jesus said, or John said, that Jesus was full of grace and truth. Despite the fact that Jesus Christ embodies truth to a level that we can never hope to come close to. Now that should be what we aspire to. But you're never going to be quite there. At least I'm not going to be there. Despite that, the invitation is that we come boldly before his throne of grace. Despite the fact that Jesus Christ is truth, he gives grace to the humble, an important qualifier. But then when we look at Hebrews chapter 4 here, on what it is that we are to do at his invitation to come boldly before his throne. Notice, the extension of mercy obviously is something that he gives, that we may obtain mercy. And then there's this little Boolean logic thing. And, I mean, here's the doing. And find the grace to help in time of need. So this extension and open invitation to come boldly before the throne of grace, where mercy is freely given and extended, comes with the caveat that we should do so and that we should only do so to find then the capacity to extend grace and help others in time of need. This is a scripture that you that I can work on for the next however many years I have left. You know, going boldly, that's a challenge to begin with. Sometimes yes, other times not so much. Sometimes not at all. I mean, it's just the frailties of human nature. And you know, it tracks back to, I mean, we're under the topic of doing. We we will never go wrong by doing what Jesus did. I mean, a long time, years ago, there was this cliche, what would Jesus do? You can have a lot of fun with that. Would. I don't know, who's the grammarian? You're the grammarian. What's the verb form of that? I know what, well, let me, Conditional, there you go. It's Möglichkeitsform. I know it in German, but I know it in English. It's conditional. Just what would Jesus do? Well, it's conditional. So you're confronted with what would Jesus do. Think about what that word would. Think about the latitude it gives you in your mind to argue. Well, you know, under these conditions, I mean, Jesus would understand and he would most probably do this. I mean, you can justify in your mind just about, I mean, if you have a creative mind like I do, you can come up with all kinds of things. But when you ask the question, what did Jesus do? It's a completely different situation. All you have to do is to find an example of what he did. And that's pretty expansive because he was in all points tested as we are, yet without sin. So all we have to do when we get to a test is, first of all, have the courage to look at what he did. Titus chapter 2, verse 11, for the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. Jesus came and extended grace, and he did so by what he did. We just have to decide whether we will do likewise. And that covers a whole expanse of things. Whole expanse. Galatians chapter 1, verse 15. But when it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace. We track back to truth is who he is, grace is what he gives. Saul was confronted by Jesus Christ on the Damascus Road. Next to the grace that was extended to David for adultery and murder, this is perhaps the greatest example of grace ever given. Jesus extended grace to Saul, who not only had killed followers of the way, but was actually on the way to Damascus to do even more so. Now, what would humanly have been done, what humans would have done, is they would have clobbered Saul, wasted him out, never given him a chance to do anything, and gotten rid of him. Jesus Christ had the capacity to not only confront, but convert Paul to become the most prolific writer and preacher of the New Testament. I mean, it's a remarkable transformation. That Jesus, who he is truth, but what he gives is grace. Paul is a prolific example of that. Ephesians chapter 2, even when we were dead in trespasses, he made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. Again, it's what was given. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. I mean, that is very clear in my mind, it seems. It is also very, very difficult. And that is why I think, I mean, we can attribute all the baloney that is taught about grace to the deceptions of Satan, and so it may be, but you can also attribute it to just you know, the frailties of human. There are a lot of people out there with good intentions who just, you know, don't get it, okay? But notice why. I mean, you think about it. Look at the conditions that are given here. It says, for by grace you have been saved through faith. You've got to believe. It is difficult to believe in our secular society. It is difficult to believe in anything. I mean, if you look at, I was having a discussion with a young man this week, which gave me a little bit of pause. I said something about church or going to church, and he said, oh, so you're a man of faith. I thought, wasn't that obvious? What did that say about who I am? I asked the question in my mind. I mean, it may not have been a statement at all. He's a young man, a nice young man, who comes from the most Catholic region in Germany. And he talked about the fact that he left the church. Now, that has differences in meaning and consequences from here. What it means in Germany is, in order to be a Catholic, you get taxed by the state for being a Catholic. And he had an experience where their parents got an inheritance, then the church came and said, well, you know, and finally he just said, you know what, I believe, but I don't believe in this stuff. And it came down when you had all the scandals for, you know, child abuse and the way the Catholic Church handled that. So this is a young man who still, he says, I believe in some respects, I just don't belong to a church. And I said, well, we're part of eine Freikirchliche Gemeinschaft. We were talking in German. So we're an independent, what they would call a free church. Oh, he said, well, that would be kind of good. You know, you're not, you know, locked into, you know, one of the big churches that has done all of those things. This grace through faith, it's a big topic. You know, you go to university, you get a degree, they work overtime to get you to not believe. So, you know, when I'm just saying this, that, you know, if we are saved through faith by grace, I mean, getting to that point is a major hurdle in our society. And that not of yourselves, and then it goes to the gift aspect. It's a gift that's given. You give gifts. You are truth. So it comes back down to, I mean, I think you can, again, boil it down to this. Who we are determines what we see, think, say, and do, and then what we do determines who we become. And hopefully, if we do and follow Jesus Christ, the result of that will be that as we follow that, we will become full of grace and truth. Cho got a couple bonus points. All right. So that's it. We'll continue it in the sermon.